Change is the existential threat of our time, end quote. And the Earth's oceans reached record temperatures for the third year in a row last year, according to new analysis published in the journal Advances in Atmospheric Sciences. The data shows that Earth's oceans warmed 8 times faster since the late 1980s than in the preceding decades, which researchers say is only possible because of human-caused climate change. Scientists attribute recent record-breaking hurricane seasons to warming oceans, which provide more energy for storms. Warming oceans also threaten to disrupt massive ice shelves in the Antarctic, which could then slip into the water and spur even greater increases in sea level. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 47 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 40 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
The right to vote and or accepting the results of the vote. Will they be accepted? The rise of racist and fascist militias, including in the U.S. military and law enforcement, as well as real concerns of another attempted coup. Can the lid be kept on, or is Pandora's box already too wide open? The charges of sedition have now been made against the leader of the Oath Keepers, but will those charges remain low-hanging fruit? The latest from the Supreme Court on the COVID pandemic. Any winners or losers here? And on the international front, tensions on the rise. U.S., Russia, China. Does the establishment need a little war, or is that a bridge too far? And we have to remember all of this in the context of climate change. Our panelists are Jackie Goldberg, Laura Carlson, and Dr. Gerald Horn. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Biden is all but conceding defeat for this year for voting rights legislation. Biden spoke at the Capitol after a key fellow Democrat, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, dramatically announced her refusal to go along with changing Senate rules to overcome a Republican filibuster. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden made a last push Thursday for voting rights legislation headed to the Senate. He met with Senate Democrats to urge changing the Senate filibuster rule to allow a majority vote on the bill. But by then, it was probably too late. Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona spoke on the Senate floor shortly before an expected vote, where she talked about building bridges and forging common ground.
And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country.
Soon after, Joe Manchin of West Virginia issued a written statement saying he would not vote to eliminate or weaken the filibuster. Despite the apparent setbacks, Biden is renewing his vow to keep moving forward on what he sees as a crucial issue.
It's about election subversion, not just whether or not people get to vote. Who counts the vote? As long as I'm in the White House, as long as I'm engaged at all, I'm going to be fighting to change the way these legislatures have moved.
I'm Christopher Martinez.
The founder and leader of the far-right Oath Keepers militia group, and 10 other members or associates have been arrested and charged with seditious conspiracy in the January 6 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The Justice Department announced the charges against Stuart Rhodes and the others. It's the first time the department has brought a seditious conspiracy charge in connection with the attack. Rhodes is the highest-ranking member of an extremist group to be arrested in the deadly siege. The indictment alleges Oath Keepers for weeks discussed trying to overturn the election results and preparing for a siege by purchasing weapons and setting up battle plans. They repeatedly wrote in chats about the prospect of violence and the need, as Rhodes allegedly wrote in one text, to, quote, scare the S out of Congress. Authorities have said the Oath Keepers and their associates worked as if they were going to war, discussing weapons and training. The U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority has struck down the Biden administration rule requiring large employers to mandate their workers get a COVID-19 vaccination or test regularly and wear a mask on the job. The justices ruled 6-3. In a separate 5-4 decision, the justices upheld a vaccine mandate for most health care workers. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh ruled with the liberal justices in the second case. Mike Clifford reports.
The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday blocked President Biden's COVID-19 vaccination or testing mandate for large businesses, a policy the conservative justices deemed an improper imposition on the lives and health of many Americans, while endorsing a separate federal vaccine requirement for health care facilities. Biden expressed disappointment with the conservative majority court's decision. Biden said it's now up to the states and employers to decide whether to require workers to take this simple and effective step of getting vaccinated. This is Mike Clifford for Public News Service.
In their dissent, the court's three liberal justices argued it was the court that was overreaching by substituting its judgment for that of health experts. Health officials say the East Coast may have reached its peak of Omicron cases, which will now decline. Not so yet for California and the rest of the West Coast, where cases continue to rise. Los Angeles County Public Health Director Dr. Barbara Ferrer said more than 4,000 people are hospitalized with COVID-19 in LA County. She said even once cases peak, hospitalizations are likely to continue growing.
The sad thing is once we see these increases, they're likely to continue for a few weeks after cases plateau or begin to decline. And while it's reassuring that much of the scientific evidence to date suggests that Omicron causes milder illness for many people, particularly those vaccinated and boosted, we still have no idea what percent of those recently infected with Omicron will experience long COVID.
Tennis star Novak Djokovic faces deportation after the Australian government revoked his visa for a second time. Immigration Minister Alex Hawke says he used his ministerial discretion to revoke the visa on public interest grounds 3 days before the Australian Open begins. Djokovic's lawyers are expected to appeal. The Prime Minister welcomed Djokovic's pending deportation, saying Australia has achieved one of the lowest pandemic death rates, strongest economies, and highest vaccination rates in the world. Everyone at the Australian Open is required to be vaccinated. Djokovic is not and had sought an exemption because he had COVID-19 in December. I'm Eileen Alfandere for Pacifica Radio.
This is our first weekly roundtable of 2022, and we're going to be digging in, getting our panelists' thoughts on the drift towards fascism in the United States, authoritarianism. Is that the case? Do they agree with that? We're going to focus on two fronts, on the crisis around the right to vote, and even if one votes, of the crisis around accepting the results of the vote, and also the rise of racist and fascist militias in the U.S. military, in law enforcement, even among prison guards, and real concerns of another attempted coup. Now there are charges of sedition against the head of the Oath Keepers, so we'll see how the committee The House of Representatives, that panel, they're continuing to investigate the deadly January 6th insurrection in the U.S. Capitol, and they are aiming to hold lengthy public hearings this year detailing what they say in vivid color, the events that took place both at the Capitol as well as in the White House. The congressional panel aims to conduct multiple weeks of public hearings sometime this year. And, you know, it's a crucial year, midterm elections, where the GOP hopes to retake majority control. Right now, people are predicting perhaps of both chambers of Congress. But the hearings are aiming to lay out what happened every minute of the day on January 6th and at the White House, what led to that violent attack. Now, subpoenas, in addition to the arrest of the head of the Oath Keeper that you heard in our news headlines, subpoenas have also been issued for social media giants, including Facebook, now Meta, and Twitter, and others. And the committee, the congressional committee, also has to decide whether it's going to subpoena one of its own, Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader. And a lot of people are waiting to see if the Department of Justice will indeed subpoena Mark Meadows, who was the chief of staff in the Trump White House. So there's a lot going on there, as well as the efforts to weed out extremism in the U.S. military. There are 50,000 people who join the U.S. military each and every year. So let us go now to a couple of clips to set this up for us, and then we'll go to our panelists.
Day.
So it's literally watching what felt like democracy falling, honestly. So it's pretty scary.
And sobering for the Pentagon in the wake of the attack, outlining new guidelines and definitions for prohibited extremist activities, beginning for the first time at recruiting centers.
Do you have any new ties to or associations to any extremists or hate groups now?
No.
So weeding out extremism or extremists right now at this stage is very important, because this is where everything is going to start at. The people that's coming in right now are going to be the people that's leading us in about 20 years, 15 years down the line.
Commanders can also look at service members' social media history once a red flag is raised, and the guidance includes what constitutes dissemination of extremist materials online, such as posting, liking, or retweeting. But so many say there's still so much more that needs to be done.
When we talk about veterans and their willingness to serve, they have an undying patriotism. And when politicians can manipulate that, that's going to give them a lot of power. We've got to find some way to reach these veterans, and they're not falling into these groups where they are being indoctrinated and they're being radicalized and they're doing what they did on January 6th.
And with the number of extremist crimes committed by veterans even outside of January 6th jumping significantly in the past decade, the worry is without even further action, it will only get worse.
There are new developments in the sprawling investigation into the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The Justice Department has filed the most serious charges yet against the militia group Oath Keepers. Some of the defendants charged with seditious conspiracy are from Central Florida. The group's leader is now the highest ranking member of an extremist group to be arrested in the deadly riot. Prosecutors say the 11 Oath Keepers charged today with seditious conspiracy began planning for an attack shortly after President Biden's victory became official.
It's just amazing that Trump let the election be stolen out from under him and then let our country be stolen like this, our government.
The far-right extremist group's notorious leader, Stuart Rhodes, a former Army paratrooper with a Yale law degree, sent a message to a group chat on November 5th. We aren't getting through this without a civil war. Over the next month, prosecutors say Rhodes, arrested today in Texas, used encrypted apps to organize the January 6th assault. Members of the Oath Keepers, outfitted in full combat gear, were seen marching in a military-style stack formation through the crowd up the east steps of the Capitol. Prosecutors say Rhodes, who was not inside the Capitol, was directing them via cell phone and a chat app. The indictment alleges the stack split in two, once inside the Capitol, one towards the Senate chamber to disrupt the certification, and the other toward the House in search of Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Prosecutors say Rhodes had several armed quick-reaction forces on standby in Virginia that could be called in to escalate the attack. To date, about two dozen Oath Keepers have been charged in connection with the insurrection.
It wasn't just an unruly mob.
Harry Littman is a former U.S. attorney.
We're past the point of seeing this as some kind of spontaneous riot and really into seeing it as an actual assault on the operation of U.S. law itself.
Rhodes' attorney disputed the allegations in the court documents, including the charge that after all the violence at the Capitol, some of the Oath Keepers met at a restaurant in Virginia to plan what would happen next to prevent Joe Biden from taking office.
All righty, there you go. The first clip from ABC News and the other from CBS Miami, the one on the Oath Keepers. I'd now like to welcome our guests. Also, by the way, I said 50,000 joining the military each year. Actually, it's 500,000 who apply and 200,000 who go into the military each year. So it's a lot of folks to keep track of in terms of tamping down extremism. But I'd like to now welcome our panelists, Laura Carlson, director of the Americas Program. She works with Just Associates, an international feminist organization based in Mexico City. She's a regular contributor to America's Update, or Foreign Policy in Focus, Counterpunch, and several Spanish language publications. She's also a television host and commentator on globalization, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues for various international news outlets. Laura Carlson, all the best to you and your loved ones, and we need all the strength we can going into 2022. Welcome.
Same to you, Margaret.
And I'd also like to welcome Jackie Goldberg, who is a governing board member for the Los Angeles School Board District 5. She is a former member of the California State Assembly. Jackie Goldberg has previously served as a member of the Los Angeles City Council. Before being elected to council, she served on and was later president of the Los Angeles School Board. Jackie Goldberg also wishes to you and your loved ones for 2022. And welcome back. We've missed you.
Happy New Year. Good to be back.
All righty. And Dr. Gerald Horn, Morris Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's written more than 30 books. His most recently published book is The Bittersweet Science, Racism, Racketeering, and Political Economy of Boxing. He is also the author of The Dawning of the Apocalypse, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, Settler Colonialism, and Capitalism in the Long 16th Century. Dr. Horn, greetings to you for 2022, and welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Laura Carlson, we're actually going to start with you. You heard what was said on the clips. A lot of people are concerned that the United States puts itself forward as the bastion of democracy is actually drifting towards fascism. What happened with President Biden's agenda, his care economy agenda, Build Back Better, including the child tax credits and help for elderly, et cetera, stuck in the Senate, blocked, by the way, by all Republicans. We have to remember that, but also two Democrats, Kristen Sinema of Arizona, as well as Manchin out of West Virginia. And now it seems as though the voting rights bills, that it doesn't look as though anything is going to happen with them either, unless something happens with the filibuster. And as of yesterday, as of Thursday, both Sinema and Manchin said that they weren't going to be, you know, weren't going to go along with the program, so to speak. So talk about that on the one hand, the threat to the vote, and then on the other hand, this and rise. Or maybe it was always there, but certainly more visible, of these right-wing racist militias, not only across the country, but in the U.S. military. Laura Carlson.
Thanks, Margaret. Well, Joe Biden went to Atlanta, and he gave a good speech and a strong speech, but the question is, who is he speaking to? To go before a mostly young, progressive audience in Atlanta was a symbolic move, but it wasn't really strategic. And it makes you wonder if his point is really to defend what he calls the soul of the nation, because voting rights are at the center of democracy, or just to create an historical place marker and look back and say, well, when we lost our democracy, I made a great speech. You know, I know that sounds a little bit cynical, but I'm not the only one who's viewing this from a critical strategic point of view. In Georgia, a coalition of civil rights groups and voting rights activists led by Black Voters Matter announced they weren't going to attend Biden's speech, and the head of the Georgia NAACP said, we're asking for him to take this seriously and to outline an actual plan. They should be in D.C. So where is the real strategy for defending voting rights? The strategy up to now of mollycoddling Manchin and Sinema has done exactly what Manchin and Sinema wanted it to give those two egomaniacs a national spotlight for practically the entire year. It's inconceivable to me, Margaret, how after Kyrsten Sinema stood up in the Senate to torpedo the Voting Rights Act, essential for the survival of democracy, by spewing nonsense about division, Biden would invite her to talk about it, where it was reported she spent most of the time on her phone, no doubt conferring with her right-wing handlers. So Biden, it seems like, is repeating the fatal mistakes that he saw Obama make. When Obama, who had the legislature, insisted on bipartisan support for something as critical as immigration reform and, of course, lost it, there has to be a point where we acknowledge that approximately one-third or more of the population and half the Senate no longer believes in democracy. Historically, we know that some of the most important advances in the nation's history began as minority measures, especially in terms of Congress, which is not surprising because this is a system that developed, that condoned and fed off slavery and later institutionalized racism. It's a system that's incapable of passing an equal rights amendment for women, and it will not budge unless it's pushed. The right has a strategy, so this isn't just a battle to swing some votes. The Republicans, we've seen now over the past year, are wielding power with everything they've got, and they have been since the beginning. There is no chance of a good faith intention to negotiate absolutely anything, and they have no concern for governance. The infrastructure bill was stripped of critical climate change and infrastructure measures, as you mentioned. Build Back Better was apparently sacrificed in the process. And in this context, I'm really not sure if what we're seeing here is the naivete of Joe Biden and the Democratic Party or the complicity. It's a real question. There's Richard Nixon used to always assert and complain that he had a silent majority behind him, because back then you still had to pay lip service at least to democracy and majority rule. But now Donald Trump is very clear that he has the militant minority behind him, and it's a heavily armed militant minority. So this makes it a new game. It's the raw use of illegal power and the manipulation of power, and the Democrats have to rise to that occasion. The population has to be aware of it, because I do agree that we are looking at an attempted takeover on many different levels. In terms of the militias, a recent article by Catherine Bellew of the University of Chicago and the Washington Post describes them accurately, I think, as extra-legal, unregulated private armies, and they are on the rise. They provide private protection for the right-wing, white nationalist leaders. They're shock troops against Black Lives Matter protesters on frequent occasions. They're the guards at Republican events. And we have to remember, now that it's the five-year anniversary, that they've also been involved in public land takeovers like that in my home state of Oregon at the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge. So they've received very light sentences, and I don't believe in calling for tougher prison sentences, but we have to find ways to send far clearer messages that all of this behavior violates the law and has to be sanctioned. And then just finally on the military, it's a really, really important point, because so many of these people do have military training. So it's not enough to just include a question on the recruiting, you know, the recruiting interviews. We have to look at what's happening in U.S. military training. It's also highly correlated with domestic violence, and domestic violence against women is often present in the profiles of white supremacist violence. We are somehow teaching people that the use of brute force against law and against others is not only justified, but is somehow their right. So with 200,000 people entering that kind of training a year, it's time that we seriously revise the values and the practices that are there, which are really not very transparent at all.
The director for the Center for Peace Studies and Violence Prevention, according to The Guardian, has said that the country has been moving more and more towards violence, not away from it. And before January 6th, there were at least 300 militia groups across the United States. And who knows if that is an accurate count and whether and what has happened since January 6th, where they've been doing a lot more recruiting and a lot more fundraising. And then it looks as though the spate, the riot of these voter suppression laws, the challenge of the right to vote is moving ahead full steam. Jackie Goldberg.
Yes, indeed, it is moving ahead full steam, but it's not new. We've had militia movements in the United States for a very long time. They've always been right-wing anti-government extremist movements. They sort of began in 93, 94 in large numbers in reaction to the federal gun control measures, because they decided that that the whole point of government was now to take their guns away from them. And so they believe that the federal government is collaborating, you know, with this shadowy conspiracy of the New World Order to strip Americans from rights. So they see themselves as patriots. They like to use language that describes them as like people who were in 1776 bringing a new world order to the world. Of course, it was, something that called for militias, I don't think, because the only militia really that's legal in the United States is the National Guard. That's the militia. They declined for a while, but beginning in about 2008, they began really recruiting again. Often young people, often people from the military, often people still in the military, still in the police, before they had been recruiting people after they left the military and police. Now they're including people in the military and in the police. But I think really it was election of Trump that really changed the emphasis of the militia movement, because now they believe that their goal is to get rid of Antifa or something like that, or to oppose gun control measures, or to oppose state-level pandemic restrictions. So they are a big part of the anti-COVID, anti-vax kind of things. I think it's important for us to understand that this extreme right groups really have a long, long history in this country. Prior to World War II, there was the Silver Shirt Legion, I believe. I remember reading of the Christian Front in America. The Cold War led us to having groups called the Christian Patriot Defense League and the Texas Emergency Reserve. So what I'm saying is that there have always been folks who have decided that they are patriots by opposing a democracy. In this country, this is not new. So what we're really seeing is that they've been using the standoff like Ruby Ridge and Waco to say that, to prove to the people they're recruiting that the federal government is willing to murder them, to put them in concentration camps, to declare martial law, to take their guns away. And so they say that they are fighting Black Lives Matter movement, they're fighting communism, they're fighting Marxists. They have a variety of things they're fighting, but mostly, basically, what they believe is that they have the right to use weapons, and that they have a right to do them, and that they are, in fact, the people who are saving America. And I think that what this does is, I think this reminds us that we have to take much more seriously how we train not just military, but police as well. And remember that the whole change in how police behave began after the Vietnam War, when folks came back and were immediately recruited into police departments around the country. So what we have is a group of people who have a long history of violence, connections in the United States. We think that there are at least 50 active militia groups right now. This is according to a couple of organizations that track them. They believe that the number of incidents involving violence that involve former police, current police, former military, current military has doubled in the last several years. And it believes that, and I believe that they are a serious danger because they have a desire, as we saw in this recent indictment, on serious conspiracy charges. The folks from we saw that indictment. We saw those 11 people. We saw that they were planning this. This was not, you know, oh my goodness, we had a January 6th demonstration and suddenly, boom, it got out of hand. No. There was planning into this. They had guns off nearby, just outside of Washington, D.C. to bring in. They were prepared for war. Their text talked about the second Civil War or Civil War 2.0. I think we need to take very seriously that these militias are a big part of the far right extremist attempts to change America and to make it no longer as closer to a democratic Republican as it was trying to be. Now it says we don't even think that's a good idea.
Right. Thank you, Jackie Goldberg. And Dr. Gerald Horn, I mean, if we look at the Republican Party today, it's 90% white, okay, despite the one or two black people that show up, you know, black people for Trump, which they like to parade around. You see that Fox News, Tucker Carlson, the conservative Fox News network, the most watched host on television today, you know, so there's a lot of information that people are getting that's basically false and lies. And it just seems to me as though this whole thing stinks, Dr. Horn, from the top way going all the way down. And Donald Trump, which some people refer to as white supremacist in chief, we knew was fanning the flames of all of this. So when you look at U.S.-style fascism and U.S.-style authoritarianism, it might look a little bit different than it did in other countries, but it has some of the same elements. I mean, in the lead-up to what happened in Germany, for example, it was the Jewish population, the gypsies, gay people, et cetera, who were vilified. In the United States, we know there is nothing that isn't seen from with the lens of race, so to speak. So your thoughts, Dr. Horn, in all of this, because for a lot of people, it's a very scary moment. And people are also saying on the Civil War question that it's not necessarily going to look like it did in the first U.S. Civil War, but perhaps skirmishes, maybe some people are saying maybe along the lines of what was happening in Ireland, for example, between the it looked as though it was religious, but it really wasn't. In terms of those loyal to the UK and those wanting independence. So, Dr. Horn, your thoughts on all of this?
Well, first of all, this proto-fascist movement may constitute a minority, but what we need to look at strategically is that the Republican Party has a stranglehold on the white majority. And in this country, historically, you can move mountains if you have a stranglehold on the majority of the population that are the descendants of European settlers. And that is what we're facing today, and we should not downplay that at all. You mentioned Hitlerism in the 1930s. Well, as historians well know, when Hitler was rising to power in the 1930s, he made a point of suggesting that he was only trying to accomplish to the east of Germany what the United States had accomplished in the west of North America with the genocide against Native Americans, and how that did not necessarily raise a flutter amongst many in this country and certainly hardly around the world, and he thought he could do the same thing in Europe. We should also take account of what's happening in the newspapers. We should study carefully that op-ed that appeared in the Washington Post just a few days ago by three leading U.S. generals that predicted a coup in November 2024 following the election. The states are already gearing up to seize the ballot boxes, at least metaphorically, if not practically. And then there was the op-ed in the Toronto Globe and Mail just a few days ago, the New York Times of Canada, where it was suggested that Ottawa prepare for a flood of U.S. refugees into Canada following this coup that many are expecting. Obviously, many in the progressive movement have not done a good job of preparing us for this perilous moment. They basically swallowed liberal narratives and conservative narratives about the United States being this citadel of democracy, which is obviously nonsensical in light of voter suppression that's taking place, as Mr. Biden pointed out quite correctly in his Atlanta speech, not to mention the police terror, which has a good deal of the black population terrorized on a regular basis. I find it quite telling that a book that is being debated as we speak by the UC San Diego political scientist Barbara Walter about civil wars and how we might be on the verge of one in the United States, that in this book, she is more insightful than many on the U.S. left, even though she happens to be a consultant to the CIA. What I mean is she points to identity politics as being a leading indicator. Now, when the U.S. left speaks of identity politics, they speak of black nationalism. Some of them even speak of feminism. She's speaking of whiteness and white supremacy and the construction of whiteness, which somehow has eluded the intelligence of many of our friends on the left as they fixate on these questions that are irrelevant to the issue of fascism, such as black nationalism. And then you look at the reaction to January 6th, the attempt to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. I recommend to your audience the HBO documentary, 4 Hours at the Capitol, which talks about how these insurrectionists brought firearms and handcuffs and bear spray and pepper spray and spears and baseball bats, 140 officers injured. And yet, a leading light of the U.S. left, Glenn Greenwald, has downplayed the profundity and significance of January 6th. He basically sees it as a Democratic Party demagogic talking point. And yet, as a black person in the United States, you know that if hundreds or thousands of black people invaded the Capitol with all of those weapons, there would have been a mountain of cadavers. And yet, there was only one person shot, Ashley Babbitt, who is now a martyr of the right wing. And, of course, she happened to be shot by a black officer. And so here you have this Greenwald character, born in the United States with this huge black population, living in Brazil with an even larger black population. And the question of race and racism obviously does not occur to him, which, of course, is one of the blind spots of the U.S. left generally, which is why we're on the verge of fascism as we speak. Now, here we are on the day before Martin Luther King's birthday, January 15th, and before the holiday mark on Monday, January 17th, and there will be this occasion for mutual backpatting and self-congratulation, when actually we need a co-eyed analysis of what's happened since the mid-1950s with the erosion of Jim Crow. If we do that, we'll realize that that movement was driven as much by global events, the fact that the United States was trying to posed as a paragon of democracy and human rights and had difficulty appealing to hearts and minds in the developing world as long as apartheid stained the national escutcheon. This is even mentioned in the Brown versus Board of Education decision of 1954. And so, therefore, you have these mass riots in Little Rock in 1957, Boston in the 1970s, Yonkers in the 1980s, all against this idea of desegregation. Many either dismissed them or portrayed them as the last gasp of dead enders. But I think now in the light of recent events, we should take that movement quite seriously. And likewise, we should also realize that the movement against Jim Crow was preceded by a weakening of the left, the basic attack on people like Paul Robeson, the attempt to deport Harry Bridges, the leader of West Coast Longshore, back to his native Australia on grounds that he was a supposed communist. And how could any movement of working people advance when the labor left was under siege? That is one lesson we should take away from this movement against Jim Crow over the past 75 years. And finally, I think the U.S. left needs to stop making excuses for the backwardness of these Euro-Americans who vote for Trump. and Trump isn't, you would think that there are basically misunderstood social Democrats, even though we know that in 1991, 55% of Euro-Americans in Louisiana voted for a Nazi David Duke for governor. The left would have us believe that if the Democrats had just come out for Medicare for all, their votes would have been switched. But, of course, we all know that if you tell many of these Euro-Americans that some social welfare benefit will go to a single black mother, they'll flip in a minute and vote for fascism. And until we realize that, we're all going to be in danger.
Right. Well, Dr. Horn, the words we all have to pay attention to, just really great analysis from all of our panelists here. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take our station break now. By the way, Dr. Horn, the book, I'm sure the book that you referred to by Barbara Walter, who is a political scientist at the University of California, San Diego, her new book is How Civil Wars Start and How to Stop Them. And one interesting thing reported in The Guardian about what she was saying is about the emergence of a government that is neither fully democratic or fully autocratic, or something called an anocracy. Well, we'll see. Well, let's continue our discussion here. We're going to take a short station break. Our panelists will stay with us, where we'll be having, they'll weigh in briefly on the latest on the Supreme Court decision in relation to Biden's mandates around the pandemic. But also, we're going to go into our international front and these growing international tensions, and some even talking about the specter of war, given the conflict centered on the Ukraine that's happening between the U.S. and Russia, and with NATO very much front and center. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Such a friction that it bring about a great insurrection, and it spread all over the nation. It was truly an historical occasion. It was the end of the year, and I wish I had been there when we run riot all over Brixton.
Alrighty, and that music is Linton Kwesi Johnson. Great intervention. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. It is our weekly roundtable, and our panelists are Laura Carlson, Jackie Goldberg, and Dr. Gerald Horn. And what I'd like to do now in the time that we have left is to ask our panelists to comment both on the Supreme Court decision on the pandemic and all of the implications. And Jackie Goldberg, as a school board member, you may have some things to say about that, but also what's happening in the schools, but also to go into the international front, the tensions that are growing between the U.S. and Russia around the Ukraine, in particular NATO cozying up to Russia's borders. But also, Laura Carlson was on earlier in the week talking about some good news on the international front coming out of Latin America. And Jackie Goldberg, what we'd like to do is to go to start with you, because we know you have to jump off a bit earlier today. So your thoughts on the pandemic, as well as any thoughts you have on the international front. Jackie Goldberg.
Yes, on the pandemic, I think that, now the Supreme Court can take some responsibility for all of the people who will die because they will not be required to get vaccinated. So I think they can join the growing number of people who have responsibility for the large number of people dying unnecessarily. You know, dying in a pandemic when there's no vaccination, everybody feels is a tragedy. It's not just a tragedy. It's a crime when you do it to your own people. I think that they showed what liars and cheats they are by, as the Supreme Court did, by saying that, well, yeah, we can require it of some people. I guess if I'm in the hospital, I don't want person taking care of me to be, sick with COVID. So, yeah, let's take care of them. They have to do it, but nobody else. Nobody else has to do it because, you know, freedom, 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 freedom. Well, you know, the one purpose of OSHA is protecting public health of workers. That's their only job. The Supreme Court's job is not to decide what health issues should be decided or to decide what is real science and not science. Its job is not that, and I think the three dissenters were very clear on that. Who won and who lost? Well, of course, the right wing thinks it won a great victory, but the victory comes with loss of life of their constituents. The death rates in states with low vaccinations is much higher than the death rate in states with high vaccinations. We have a big surge in California, but we're not having a big surge in deaths. And although at the rate the hospitalizations are increasing, even that might change. As to how this affects schools, well, schools are fighting all over the country for the right to demand vaccination for at least their employees and some for their students. And, of course, what this does is make it much more difficult for them to do that, which means that you will see more schools closing because they have transmission. I want to tell you, we have 1,400 schools and over 400,000 students. Since schools opened in Los Angeles Unified, there has not been a single case of at-school transmission, not one case. Why? Because we require vaccinations of our students and our folks that are students 12 and up, and we require vaccinations of all employees to be on campus. We test weekly. If people don't do that, what they're doing is they're going to be finding that a greater number of children are going to be hospitalized and some will even die. This is a tragedy of our own making, of the making of the right wing and of those folks who support them, like the Supreme Court of the United States.
Right. And Jackie Goldberg also...
Did you want me to comment internationally as well? I would just say
yes.
That Moscow,
yes.
Moscow's assertiveness is making NATO crazy. And, you know, I think I do think that if there is a possibility of any actual exchange of weapons and violence, it would be in the Ukraine. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Russia is trying to say, I'm sorry, my phone's ringing, trying to say that we should be trying to deal with the problem of NATO not being able to bring in Ukraine, for example. Moscow says that would be a cause for war, I believe. China's the same thing. We couldn't be more further apart, and trade, I think, will continue to be the issues in there. Okay, I got to go.
Okay, thank you, Jackie. That's quite all right. Laura Carlson, yeah, we were aware that Jackie Goldberg had to jump off earlier today. Laura Carlson, your thoughts on all this in relation to the pandemic, but also on the international front.
On the pandemic, as we know, this ruling was a conservative-liberal ruling that says that there cannot be the business mandate for businesses with 100 or more workers. It affects, according to reports, some 80 million people. And then they have, as Jackie Goldberg mentioned, you know, this contradictory ruling that, yes, indeed, they can require this for the 17 million healthcare workers at facilities that take Medicare or Medicaid payments. There's no logic here. It's a contradiction. It's hypocrisy. Essentially, the losers are, first of all, worker health. The ruling actually says that OSHA does not have the power to regulate public health. That's exactly the definition of OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. What's happened here is a long-term right-wing campaign to gut OSHA and labor rights. And Trump actually advanced considerably in this. And we saw what happened when the pandemic hit. Because it had become so weakened within OSHA, there was a very weak and a slow response, and particularly when we look at the meatpacking industry, where many immigrants work, hundreds of people died as a result. There was only recently a scathing Inspector General report in March of last year that actually attributed many of these deaths to the fact that there wasn't a serious response about the dangers that the COVID-19 virus presented to workers who were required to go and work to sustain their families. There were more complaints and fewer inspections. Secondly, the losers are the nation as a whole, because the message is not government overreach. Nobody believes that, except maybe them and some other right-wing forces. But the message is clearly that the state has no capacity to rule for the public good. even at a time when we know that the threats we face are more and more universal and that we particularly need the state to be ruling for the public good. With this ruling, private companies can impose the mandate if they want to. States can possibly impose the mandate, but there's a strong trade-off in which we lost ground between what they're defining as freedom, which is actually a serious threat to the public as a whole. On the international front, we are seeing the rise in the tensions with U.S. and particularly in the negotiations over Ukraine. And the question of whether this is the drumbeat to war, as one of U.S. diplomat called it, that is beginning to sound loud, is still up in the air. There was a cyber attack just yesterday in the Ukraine with the message, be afraid and expect the worst, telling people that all their data had been made public. So there's clearly an effort by someone to increase the fear, to increase the sound of that drumbeat to war, but that doesn't necessarily mean that war is going to be the end result. They're reporting that there are 100,000 Russian troops on the border. The talks have basically stalled in large part because the United States refuses to respond to the written demands of the Russian government. And we've said it before here on this show and in other places. Wars are good for falling approval rates and for defense economies. But everyone knows that this is absolutely unjustified and that they're playing with fire here. There has to be a recognition now that we are acting in a provocative way and that the way to defuse the situation actually lies in the hands of the United States and its allies. There was a bluster. There's a huge attempt to increase the stakes for the United States. There was a statement by Russia that they would neither confirm nor exclude, between quotations, deployment in Cuba and Venezuela. And again, what this shows us also is that the superpowers continue to see the world as a chessboard. Who asked Cuba or Venezuela? You know, there's this wielding of power that completely fails to take into account the majority of the world.
I'm wondering if you could just briefly give our listeners a sense. We did discuss it earlier in the show this week, but for folks who missed it, about what seems to be a sea change happening south of the border. As the U.S. is moving more to the right, they seem to be moving more to the left. Is that a fair assessment? Just a brief comment.
Yes, and it's very important because there's some very hopeful tendencies there. We saw two elections that marked this tendency in Chile, which has been the example of neoliberalism over the past decades. They elected a young student movement leader, Gabriel Boric, who has located clearly on the left. He's committed to feminists, to the rights of diversities and of indigenous peoples, and rolling back many of the neoliberal measures that cause the increased inequality and poverty within the country, including taxing the rich and others that we've seen. He was running against an ultra-right candidate who was very similar, in fact, compared himself to Trump. So his considerable victory was a major sign that people are getting sick of the old solutions and of the extreme rhetoric of the right wing. This is also in the context of a constitutional assembly that will completely restructure the Constitution and look toward providing more equality and more equity within the country. Then there were the elections in Honduras where for the first time they elected a woman for president, Xiomara Castro, and also got rid of a close ally of the United States, accused of being a narco state, the elite led by Juan Orlando Hernandez. And so finally, that country that has suffered so much since the coup that was supported by the United States government in 2009 has a chance of digging out of the extreme corruption, pro-corporate, and repressive regime that has ruled there for the past over 10 years.
Right, and Laura Carlson, what we're going to need to do, what I'll encourage listeners to do is to go on SoundCloud or to the KPFK website and hear more in depth, because you had a lot more to say about what was going on south of the border. But Dr. Gerald Horn, we did want to yield the rest of the time to you as we wrap up our roundtable on the pandemic as well as on the international front. Dr. Gerald Horn.
Well, with regard to the pandemic, I think we need to study carefully what Senator Markey and Senator Warren of Massachusetts have suggested about changing the nature of the U.S. Supreme Court, which has become a kind of super legislature, not to mention all-knowing wizards. They've suggested that there be term limits with regard to these high court justices and or adding more members. That needs to be studied very carefully, because what they've just done is really a blow to fighting the pandemic. And the fight was already in jeopardy, because we know that until the whole world is safe, none of us are safe. And obviously there's a under vaccination level in Africa and certain parts of Latin America as well, which raises the possibility that even when Omicron retreats, that new variants might arise. And in fact, some epidemiologists are suggesting that Omicron might not be a variant. It might be a deviant. That is to say, something altogether different from the original novel coronavirus. With regard to the international situation, it's clear the United States is playing with fire in Eastern Europe. Recall what happened in October 1962 when the United States was willing to blow up the world when then Soviet Union put defensive missiles in Cuba. That issue was somehow resolved. And now you see the United States basically playing the European Union for chumps. If you look at the John Bolton memoir, the former national security advisor under Mr. Trump, or the book by Washington Post columnists Bob Woodward and Bob Costa, they suggest that Mr. Trump, and he represents a significant part of the U.S. public opinion, basically sees the European Union as second only to China as a threat to U.S. hegemony. And now you see the United States on the verge of starting a major conflict in the backyard of the European Union. Now, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, was originally anti-Soviet when it came into existence in 1949. It should have disappeared when the Soviet Union disappeared about 30 years ago. But instead, it's morphed into an anti-Russian coalition. It's not just a club. I mean, keep in mind, it was NATO that destroyed socialist Yugoslavia. It was NATO that bombed the Dickens out of Libya about a decade or more ago. And I'm afraid to say, once again, that the United States left has been played for chumps as well, because many cheered the rise of the right in Trump, in Poland. And now the Polish leaders are talking about establishing what they call Fort Trump in the heart of Europe, not far distant from Russian borders. Now, if you look at the map of Europe, you'll notice that most of Europe is Russia. Its population is about twice the size of that of Germany. Germany's population is about 80 million. And you also see that Europe is heavily dependent upon Russia for energy. You know that yesterday, the attempt by Senator Ted Cruz of Texas to impose sanctions, not only on Russia, but perhaps on Germany as well, for this gas pipeline from Russia into Germany, it failed, although barely. And what listeners need to realize is that Mr. Cruz is operating on behalf of natural gas producers on the Louisiana-Texas border, who stand to gain a windfall if this pipeline from Russia is stopped, and it would be to the benefit of producers in Louisiana, Texas, et cetera.
Right. On that note, we're going to have to leave it there, Dr. Horn. Another fascinating roundtable. I'd like to thank Wendell, who is our engineer for today, Jose Benavides, for pitching in and helping out. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, and you all, please remember to stay well and safe.
Is all of the excitement about? Well,
DJ Black Icon One, The Law, and myself, Mama Soul, are super excited to share with you the Harlem connection to women who rock. And we will be joined by a special guest as well, the one and only Miss Liv Warfield, because she is indeed a woman who rocks. So join us this Friday, 10 p.m., right here on WBAI 99.5 FM,
New York,
and worldwide on WBAI.org. And don't forget to catch the replay on Sundays at 3 a.m. And also, we invite you to take a deeper dive into the Harlem Connection radio show by listening to the program archives.
The next WBAI Community Advisory Board meeting will be held on Sunday, January 16th, 2022. The meeting will be held by teleconference calling. The call-in number is 623-60.